My name is Rachel White, and people call me the skeptical shaman. They say it like it's a contradiction, but it's not. For more than a decade, I've been researching and building tools for the spiritually homeless. You know, the curious but critical thinking people that, like me, have had a tough time navigating a landscape of gurus and grifters and crystal hippie people. Searching for a way to fill what Neil Gaiman called that God-shaped hole. All while, of course, not getting taken. As the host of the Skeptical Shaman podcast, I want to help us all develop a map of this confusing terrain. I'm going to talk to everybody, the curious, the skeptical, the cynical, and yes, even the true believers. Together, we can safely explore the world of woo and get closer to some meaningful existential truths. This is the Skeptical Shaman. And now, a word from our sponsors.
Are you feeling stuck, frustrated, or disconnected in the humdrum of everyday life, wondering where all the magic went? Is there an ancient Sumerian demon whispering Zul from inside your refrigerator, leaving you with a palpable sense of looming dread every night? Are eldritch terrors acting up and gazing back at you from the void? Well, the Totem Tarot deck might be right for you. One shuffle of these magical cards can transport you to a realm of unending adventure, providing crucial breadcrumbs as you navigate the strange and inevitable spiritual scavenger hunt of life. Purchase the Totem Tarot pack from Etsy or Amazon, then just unwrap, shuffle, and watch as the high strangeness grows from within your daily life. The Totem Tarot deck, what's your totem? Disclaimer. The Totem Tarot deck is connected to an ancient source of otherworldly metaphysical power. If you use the Totem Tarot deck, you understand that you may experience dimensional drift. Use responsibly.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Skeptical Shaman podcast. I'm your perennially optimistic and pleasant host, Rachel White of Totem Readings. And I am joined today by Dean Newland, who, as kismet synchronicity would have it, my interview with him on his incredible podcast, which is called The Business of Intuition, actually came out today, and no one planned this. No. So just saying that the universe is smiling upon us. So Dean, with that, I know you do more than just host that podcast, although it's been around forever. It's robust. You talk to people of all walks of life. Why don't you let everybody know a little bit about more broadly what you do, who you are, your point of view, your little elevator pitch.
That could take a couple hours right there.
Right.
I'll give you the elevator speech though, Rachel. Again, thank you so much for having me on this show. I really am looking forward to our conversation wherever it goes. We have a company called Mission Facilitators. We've been around 31 years. And essentially what I am is I am the CEO, founder. We have maybe about a dozen or so other people that work with us. And what we do from a very basic perspective is we help develop people, help organizations clarify their visions and execute on their plans. So what does that really mean? Well, from a very practical standpoint, and individually, we do a lot of executive coaching. I probably hang out most at the executive suite level, but we have other team members that handle other types of levels within organizations. And the company really was founded on coaching. So there's certainly a backbone that's going through this organization that is always going to kind of circle back to some of those principles. We also do a lot of training and development, block and tackle kind of stuff, train the trainer stuff. And when it comes to executive teams, a lot of team development, we're finding that, interestingly enough, I'm going to go off on a tangent, but after the pandemic and this advent of so much work that people are getting caught up in with AI and their technology, their phones, people are getting, I think, a little bit shy and lazy, if you will, about how to interact in a live setting. Mm-hmm. Just having a conversation with somebody in a room is different. I did an exercise with a group not that long ago where real basic sort of movement was taking place to kind of get us grounded physically in our bodies. And there was a little exercise around being able to take somebody's arm and, you know, sort of massage a little bit and move it around so that the other person gave up control of that arm. And then there was a small group, 10 people, but three people out of the 10 opted out. They just could not let themselves be touched. And they admitted, saying later, that, you know, a few years ago, this would have been no big deal, but their defenses are up. And I think that that's a metaphor for a lot of us. So anyway, I digress.
That's not really a digression. And I'd love I'm writing a note because I want to come back to social interaction is a perishable skill. It is. So let's not forget that. Let's get into
great
that.
Great way of putting it. Like my lettuce in my drawer in my refrigerator. It perishes. Yeah. So say what's your question? How do you want to go from there?
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's. I just felt like I was interrupting and interjecting.
No.
Let's do it.
No, not at all. You kind of wanted to go on that tangent, so I'm all game.
Thank you. So as someone, it's funny, I do a lot of things, some of them more sophisticated than others, I guess, in most people's perception. But at a fundamental level, I do, you know, tarot card readings. And prior to COVID, I would insist that all of them be in person just because I liked seeing people. I liked letting them see where I was. I was, despite being high up in a corporate position, always very suspicious of everything being online, everything being remote. Like, you know, why don't we connect as people a little bit? I'll make you a cup of tea kind of a thing. So as I continue to see people online and in person during COVID and then after, I have absolutely noticed the wholesale, and I'm generalizing, degradation of interpersonal skills. And to the point where I started to get like, should I be offended? Like, what's going on? What am I doing wrong? Almost like if you were to be, I would imagine I'm married, thank God, that's over. I'm not out there in the wild. I'm in captivity where it's safer for everybody. But dating maybe before, during, and after COVID, I bet people would, there would be a real shift too, maybe. Just an atrophying of fundamentally human elements and like basic civility. Not that people were rude, but civility, there's an energy to it. Like two people, whether one's the client and one's the practitioner, or whatever the exchange of money is, there's usually still like a shared social contract in how we conduct ourselves.
Yeah.
I would love to get your thoughts on this and how you think we can start fixing it, if it's possible.
Well, we've sort of are moving away from that shared social contract when it comes to the interpersonal face-to-face. And I would love to be able to continue to encourage more of those face-to-face kinds of activities because so much trust and collaboration and positive intimacy takes place in a face-to-face situation. Imagine you and I having this conversation in a common space. Like I'm in your, wherever you are.
I would love it.
Be in your house. Yeah. You and I are sitting down with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. We're having this conversation. It just completely creates a whole 3D, 4D experience. And the trust level, because of the fact that we get to see each other, is so much different than this flat type of environment. You know, I remember talking to some guy on my podcast who is a communication expert, and he said, we don't really get Zoom fatigue by sitting on our butts for 8 hours. We get Zoom fatigue because we don't have that kind of personal interaction and it's tiring, and that we are also too close to the cameras, by the way, and we don't see each other's hands, which conveys about 20% of our meeting anyway. So I really do think that we are losing that ability to have those sort of personal interactions. But when we do, oh my God. I mean, like the light bulbs go off and it's almost like you finally took a drink of water that you didn't know you were thirsty for in the first place. And I've seen that over and over again. We did an activity last week with a large group of people, and a lot of it was involving sort of face-to-face and some of it physical interactions. And it was a barn burner. And I think that it's not that difficult to do, but people are so hungry that they forget that they're hungry for it. And when that happens in a safe environment, and I do think we have to tiptoe into it because we do have our defenses up and we're in a sort of a fear-based environment in many cases, especially when it comes
You mean the social Spanish Inquisition that comes for everybody and makes them feel like if they say the wrong word, they're going to be convicted in the witch trials and burned at the stake? Is that maybe what
I don't know what I don't you're want to talking about, Rachel. Gee whiz.
Well, no, I'm absolutely a noted heretic and thought criminal. So I'll just say that up front.
No,
so I just know you're probably on a list somewhere now.
No, definitely. And I think going with that is your physical proximity to people. I was over doing a quick trip to the grocery store this morning to help my son out. And I asked this gal, hey, where can I find some cleaning supplies? And I came up to her and she saw me. She immediately recoiled. And it wasn't that I was that close to her. It's just that she's not used to that physical, you know, interaction.
Yeah.
Even though she's working in a, you know, in a grocery store where physical interactions happen all the time. So people bristle when we see each other, which is really too bad. But I really think that the it is the social contract is one that we are forgetting and that we desire and that we are hungry for. And that I think that the pandemic, to your point before, was not only just a virus that sort of went around the planet, but it was also created the pandemic of fear. And we already are prone to fear anyway. This just really put a lot of fuel on the fire. And we're still there. And I think we need to continue to have more face-to-face interactions and to reclaim that human innate desire for connection.
Another skill that I think is atrophied, and you've talked about this on your podcast, I think, better than anybody. Just, you know, I really got into your discussions around AI and ChatGPT. Well, because they're human scaled in a way that matters. And I've noticed on LinkedIn, and this is something someone actually publicly wrote, someone I used to work with who wasn't, between you and I and everyone listening, a very good writer when he was writing without help. But he wrote, has anyone else noticed that their language skills and their writing acumen has atrophied with their use of ChatGPT?
No.
I have. And by the way, the urge to write something cunty, don't think I didn't think about it, but then I remembered my severance agreement and the very specific language in it. I was like, it's not worth it. But of course it's atrophy. Of course it is, because you're writing, just like socially interacting, non-verbally or physically interacting, all these things are perishable skills. You either get better or worse at them with practice, discipline, dedication, all of these things. So in your world, you know, you talk to people about the business of intuition. Intuition is inherently human. It's not something AI can do. It can do other stuff. It's the logos, but the wisdom is the Sophia, right?
Yeah.
So what are you seeing with that? And where do you think adoption of AI is going to be positive for humanity or negative? And where do you see the intersection with human intuition?
Oh, wow. That's three or four questions in that one statement. But
I know. And that could be 10 hours, especially if you were Jordan Peterson. We could do that for 20 hours. And
that's a lot of morphine. So,
Bucko.
I completely agree with you that there is a decrease in people's ability to communicate verbally and also in the written form. And I do think that we are becoming so much more about, we don't read anymore. You know, I had a friend of mine who came back from a big writers conference over in New York, and he said that it's all about the micro content. It's all about these TikTok levels of content. And that's what we're getting almost seduced into. So we're losing the ability to keep focus. Think about reading a paragraph. Think about reading a book. Who can do that these days easily without start breaking out in hives? Because the focus of reading is actually a focus of thinking. I remember my very first creative writing class when I was a lad, I said, how do you become a good writer? And he says, become a good writer by writing. And by it, writing is nothing more than a tool for thinking. The thought is the content. The writing is the delivery mechanism of that. And so the more we end up losing the ability to write because ChatGPT is doing that for us, that also then means that we're no longer using the part of the brain that is thinking. And there was a great quote that I remember finding by a guy named Jacob Needleman, who wrote a book on this, I think it was called Money, the Meaning of Life. He said, materialism is a disease of the mind starved for new ideas. So think about how we are consuming everything under the planet, you know, buy this, buy that, which in and of itself isn't wrong, but are we doing it as a filler for the fact that our brains and our souls are not being nourished by good new ideas? And so we're getting mentally and intellectually flabby because of these technologies. And I was just doing another facilitation 2 weeks ago with a group of managers who I were very proud of for what they were able to accomplish in their young lives. They're like my son's age, 23 to 25, 26. And the guy who was the CHRO come to me during a break and he says, I know this is probably sacrilegious, but does it not seem that these people or this generation is having a harder time just to complete a complete sentence? Their verbal skills are really lacking. I said, I noticed that too. And he noticed it with his daughter and so forth. So I think we do definitely are in a situation where technology on one level is not allowing us, or we are getting flabby, if you will, in our ability to think, because in a sense, ChatGPT is doing that for us. I was talking to somebody over at ASU once, and I said, how is ChatGPT going to teach to change the way we teach our students? Because at one point when it came out, everybody said, oh, we have to be careful because of plagiarism. So all these processes started coming into play to make sure that these kids, these students weren't going to start using ChatGPT to write their papers. I said, okay, good luck, but let's see how you do that. Well, now what I heard from this person, don't quote me, but this is like a rumor, but this is what I heard, is that they're not only embracing ChatGPT and AI, but they're now teaching people how to get better at the prompts. Ergo, we're going to teach you how to ask the question, not come up with the answer.
So it's funny, while you're talking, all I can think is everyone is always thinks they're going to know enslavement when they see it, right? Because they think of, you know, like the Jews in Egypt being enslaved and doing physical labor, right? And what that looks like and all the images that come with that, or the transatlantic slave trade or whatever, right? We could go on and on. But this is a slavery that makes you softer. And I think it's still enslavement because you're being exploited to your detriment for a broader system that wants to extract wealth and resources from you. And it makes me, there's a spiritual aspect to this. And I know you're not maybe fully as weird woo as I am. It's funny. I'm either totally normal or
give it a shot. Insane.
Nothing in between. So there was a Austrian sort of theo philosopher named Rudolf Steiner. And Rudolf, during the First World War, gave a series of lectures about, you know, this age we are currently living in. He called it the Eremonic Age. And he said its primary symptom or manifestation was going to be materialism. And so he saw the prior age as the Luciferic Age, where Lucifer was saying, you know, ascend, go upward, be your own god, you know, conquer the gods. And to him, Eremon was this countering energy that kept everybody flattened in here, and there is no God. You're certainly not it. Mm-hmm. And all that is real is what's in front of you. And it's when you read these lectures, I think it's called the Fall of the Spirits of Darkness or something. And it's just a series of him quite extensively repeating himself, by the way. So it's not a great read because he is Austrian and they have a tendency to bloviate, shall we say? Like there's no executive summary in there. But It feels like you're reading the news. It feels like you're in present day. And he said, you know, in this way, humans would sign up for their own enslavement, thinking that nothing else existed. And they would become disconnected from, you know, their spiritual birthright. And to him, the world was filled with invisible spirits that influenced human events. Like that was one of his esoteric beliefs. And so to him, this was like the worst kind of enslavement. Because your spirits can't even come in. You can't even have contact with them anymore.
Well, going back to your other part of your question around the role that intuition may play in all this, what's becoming more clear to me is that that knowledge, that intuition, that wisdom that we might wrap all around each other can, in fact, cut through that enslavement, cut through the mindless habitual tendencies to give over your thinking and your spirit to the technology that surrounds us, or maybe even society that's around us. But it takes intentionality. It takes practice. It's like, you know, why are gyms so popular these days? You know, why do we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on gym memberships? Because we are no longer need to work out. Like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, nobody had a gym membership because they worked in the fields, right? So now we have to force ourselves into doing something for our body. You know, you wear your Garmin watch or your Apple watch to tell you that, oh, your stress level's up or you haven't had enough activity, because we are getting to the point where we don't have to. And so I think that we have to decide and be intentional about what is the quintessential human experience and protect that. And I think part of that is your intuition. It's that knowing. It's not going to be able to create an algorithm with a bunch of ones and zeros to be able to become intuitive. You know, you would probably trick us into think that I'm talking to a bot and the bot actually looks like a person and with facial expressions and it does things that make me think that I'm going to even possibly even have an attraction to that particular piece of technology. Like that movie, is it called Her? That was all about that. Right. So the guy falls in love with his bot assistant, you know, and it gets rejected because she doesn't want him. She wants to work at the level of other bots, right? I mean, that's all very possible, but we almost have to very intentionally, boldly, courageously hang on to what makes us human. And part of that is that inner knowing and is that ability to self-direct one's decisions and one's life based on something that isn't out there, it's in here.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because right now, you know, I'm a small business owner. It's harder than ever. And I'm not complaining. You know, it's fine. Let's put it that way. I'll be just fine. So don't stay up at night crying, worrying about me. But it is harder. And I talk to people that are like struggling, and there's this weird simulacra of social media where they feel like, well, everybody else is doing well. It's like, no, they're not. All those people talk to me when they're not doing that. It's a shit show. It's the red wedding of layoffs, and it has been for 2 years. And ChatGPT is displacing humans, but it's also kind of an excuse because those humans had to be displaced because the economy, you know, corporate America is just hemorrhaging overhead. They have to. Things have been effed up for a while. So right in the middle of like, okay, I'm going to do a human thing in these difficult times, and I'm going to have a human oriented business, shall we say, small business. How can someone use intuition to help them in business? I mean, your podcast, The Business of Intuition, I consider you, and I mentioned this before we hit record, as the great aggregator of the using intuition and business metadata. Have you gotten insights over the years and over all these conversations? And if you could give anybody listening some human scaled action items or things to think about just for themselves so they can beat the algorithm by being intuitive, what would those be?
Well, that's a great question. So I would say I broke it down when I did the TED Talk a few years ago that inspired the podcast and really thought about it, read about it. And there's a lot of books on intuition. There's a lot of it's smart people that have really done research on this. There's neuroscientists that have done research on this. I talked to one guy at Mayo Clinic, and we had this long conversation about what goes on in the brain when intuition starts to fire up. So sort of came down to three things, presence, purpose, and play. And presence really is to say, you need to get into a practice of being able to get yourself here, not in the future, not in the past, but be in the present moment. Now that alone is a skill that ChatGPT and all the other technologies are really creating that multi-focus where we're focusing on the future, we're focusing on the past, but we don't walk around being in the present. We're always thinking about what's coming up next or regretting what just happened. So if we could Hungry ghost is right. So I think that the uncomfortability, and I think we sometimes make ourselves busy, partly out of addiction, because that's the neurologically, the brain starts to orient itself regarding those hormones that are always in urgency addiction. But two, it's like, who wants to feel anymore? Right? So then by being in the present moment, all your demons start to show up and all of your hopes and dreams and the stuff that you've been avoiding starts to come up. But you need to deal with it, I think, in order for you to claim your humanity. So being in the present moment, having some sort of a practice around it, call it meditation, running, going to the gym, going for a long walk, whatever your case may be. But know what it is. How do you get there? And I even tell people, get there before you actually have conversations with people that are important. You're going into a meeting, get present and set your intention about being present in that meeting. The greatest meeting is not one that's well necessarily designed as correct, but when everybody's in the present moment in those meetings, by God, they are just explode with creativity and inspiration and trust. So get in the present moment, and you might even create a practice with your team to say, all right, before we start this conversation, let's all get present. Let's all just take a minute to breathe. let's all walk around the room and start feeling where our body is relative to space. Let's, you know, something, some sort of practice that brings us out of where we just were into where we are now. So that's one. Number two, so presence, purpose. So what is your purpose, not only in life, which is very esoteric, but in this moment? What's your intention? So the intention is another way of saying purpose. And that's what are you trying to create? What is your intention for this meeting, this conversation? I think that when people talk about their greatest fear, which is often public speaking, which is just a metaphor, it could be also a meeting, is that the reason why they're so afraid is because they're afraid of being judged in front of a large number of people. Well, I think that the mental focus of being able to say, what's my purpose in this particular meeting or this presentation? I got two or three nuggets that really need to be told because I believe wholeheartedly in its importance. It focuses your energy towards that intention, right? So that's another thing is purpose. And then play is just to be light about it. Let's not get too wrapped up in it. So this didn't work out as well. Let it go. Move on to something else. Like, you know, bring some fun into your activities with your team, with your conversations, bring in some humor, lighten the F up so that we can actually start interacting with each other and letting the presence guide our intuition, our knowing, and our intentionality. So those things, I think, would be really great. And the last thing I would say is, leaders, when you're running a meeting and you're talking about decision-making, there's a ton of models out there. I could spend a lot of time on this. But don't keep saying we're going to make decisions only based on facts and information and data. That's easy, and I understand those scientists out there and those doctors, evidence-based is the buzzword of the day. But sometimes what gets you to the right decision is a group of people who may not be subject matter experts, may not be able to quote line and verse out of some sort of, you know, playbook around something, but they have an intuitive feeling that this is something we should pay attention to. Let the word intuition enter into your decision-making process. Doesn't mean that you finish with it, but you might, but allow intuition to have a seat at the table when it comes to decisions. And when you do, what happens is that people start to show up differently. Those that kept quiet, kept their mouth shut.
I can't say anything because I'm not the subject matter expert. So I'm just going to sit here and shut up and look at my lap and watch my cell phone to see if any interesting conversations happen over text. Those people all of a sudden pay attention because everybody has a right to be here because your intuition, who knows what's going to show up for you, you know, and to listen to that. So that's a few things.
I love it. And it made me think of so many things. But really, one of the big ones is Rick Rubin's new book. Have you taken a look at it, The Creative Act? It's incredible. It reads like Buddhist philosophy. And he is a Buddhist, but he's a music producer who's done, by the way, my favorite albums, like the Beastie Boys, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Ghetto Boys, Johnny Cash's like last acoustic album. And yeah, he's a maestro, truly. But he talks about the beginner's mind, and his whole thing is someone who knows nothing, who's a rube, a philistine, however you want to put it in your own judgment of them, can come in and see something that will change the game in a way you could have never expected because they're not inculcated.
Yes.
In the dogma.
Yes. Yes.
And that's when you hit genius. Like, that's when art kind of is allowed to explode. And, you know, we read his book I have a Substack book club, but it reminded me of my innovation work and my work in shamanism, which is we don't know when it's going to hit or from where, but when it does, you don't confuse an innovation or like a breakthrough, an insight with anything else. It's singular. And it never happens through like restricting and constricting. You have to be playful and you have to listen. You know, some of the best conversations I have in this neighborhood are with drug dealers on the corner from the little grocery store here. I get a kick out of that. We get along just fine. And they'll say things to me almost, I'm like, I'm going to think about that all day now. Truly. And you can have these walls, I think, that go up between you and other people and the value they can offer you.
in terms of what you're going to discover?
There's a creative writing group that we are working with, and they had this program where they go to hospice and they interview the patients, many of whom are severely mentally challenged. They're you know, they're going into that stage. So their words and their phrases are just gobbledygook. But these people that come in are poets, and they go, I totally understand what they're talking about. So they take down, they have this sort of splintered conversation with these people in hospice, and they ended up creating a poem. And then when that person eventually passes, they present that poem at their eulogy. And it's just a wonderful way to be able to honor the individual. But the information that's coming through may not necessarily be a complete sentence, but there's some sense to it. There's some heart and soul and intuition that might come out, just not necessarily in the way which we think is socially understandable. You know, I think some of the kids that are coming into this planet right now are unbelievable in their abilities to transcend this physical space and to be psychic and to channel. And we've got some couple of kids in our extended family. I hear them about what sort of things that their mother is hearing and understanding from these little souls. Oh my God. So on one hand, you might say that there's this imprisonment that's going on with respect to control and ChatGPT and the laziness of our ability to think individually. And, you know, we just are sort of used to it. You know, this is the new world. So like, let's just have fun with it while we are slowly, you know, losing our own sense of humanity. We could say that that's really true. But on the other hand, we got these new kids, these new souls that are coming in here that are light bearers, and they are truly transcending and become sort of the future leaders of our whole society. There's a wonderful, interesting book I may have mentioned on the podcast that you were involved in called The Fourth Turning.
Yes. Yeah, and I've since gotten it, by the way. Yes.
Oh my God. So those of you who haven't looked at it, it's written like 1999 or maybe 2003. It's a fairly, you know, 20 some odd plus years ago. But these researchers basically were looking over history and finding out that there are turnings, or you could say blocks of 20 year increments over a period of 80 years that each one is very distinct in what goes on in the majority of society. And the first one, I believe, is called the High. And right after World War II in our country, we were going through a high of great employment. Everybody's on the same page. There was just this tremendous uplifting period. And then when Kennedy was shot, I believe we went into the second phase, which was about the awakening. And then, of course, we had, you know, the 60s movement and all of the questioning authority that took place, and rock and roll, some of the greatest music ever developed then. And then the third one was somewhere around Reagan's second inaugural period. And that was the unraveling. And that took us all the way up to about 2008, when we had the great, you know, recession. And now we're in the fourth one, which is called crisis. And we've already seen evidence of that, the divisiveness that's going on, what's going on in our southern borders right now, what happened with the pandemic, and more is to come. It'll probably last up until 2025, 2028. But the reason why I bring that up is that these little souls that are coming in right now are going to be leading the next high that will start in 2028. So these kids will already be up and running and thinking and moving and making things happen. And I do think that even now that one could say, oh, that's a bummer idea, Dean. Thank you very much. I'm depressed. But no, if you go out in your backyard in spring at the end of a deep winter, you start to see little shoots of growth. There are shoots of growth that are happening right now that become the
By the way,
happening.
Literally right now. And what you don't know, because you're not deep woo necessarily the way some other people are. You are, but, you know, it's not.
And you're okay. I want to get my deep woo t-shirt though, Rachel.
No, you don't. It's not. It's a dream catcher, and no one likes it. And it's not that great. And the meetings suck, by the way. But no, what the fourth turning? Because I've been reading it. What struck me is number one, a big thing in Western astrology is happening, and it's Pluto and Aquarius, and it hasn't happened since the French and American Revolution. And we are literally in this age of Aquarius cycle. But right at that same moment, February 10th of this year, we enter the year of the wood dragon. And the wood dragon is symbolized by shoots of new growth that become tall redwoods. And I wrote about it on my Substack, and I pulled an I Ching coin. You know, I Ching's like the original ancient tarot runes, whatever. And I Ching coin was revolutions molting. And it said a time of political revolutions, but of molting, of shedding an old skin and entering the new. So what's funny about this stuff to me is you read something like The Fourth Turning and you talk to very reasonable people with their finger on the pulse, historians, right? They talk about cycles, and then you talk to your strange cousin with all the dream catchers, and she's like, well, do you know what Pluto's doing? And you're like, oh my God, what are the odds? And it's not just a few of these. It's like 10 of these things converging. We also have the end of the Kali Yuga cycle in Jainism and Hinduism. You know, I could bore you to death. Ancient Sumerian religious texts, the cuneiform said that the Anunnaki come back, TikTok, like right now. We're in this. So in terms of those revolutions and the shedding, I think we're going to, even though, you know, birth is painful and the contractions seem to be getting closer together, I agree with you. I think we give birth to something. And I think a very special kind of soul is coming in the young people now. But also, I am, as of the last several months, finding more age peers to talk to that are not necessarily like weirdos like me. They're not shamans, right? They do different stuff. And I am super, what's the term I want to look for? Like, I don't want to say comforted by their existence, like yours or other people, but there's another word that I'm sure is better. I'm brain farting. My microdose might have not been so micro. But do you know what I mean? Like, I think there's another kind of soul that's between the ages of like 35 and 55 that came in to get into combat, to do the shedding, to get the bridge, if you will, from one cycle or one turning to another.
I forget it because I've not gone into the deep parts of the book yet. But I do know that each of those particular turnings that we just described, the role of leader is different for each one. So I don't remember what the role is that you are for the fourth turning. But of course, there's a certain, you know, calling for people at that particular time. And you might say this doesn't sound right, but what's wonderful about this book is they go back several hundred years and they map out what took an actual historic reference and be able to say, well, this was the beginning of the second turning and the third turning. And you could say, oh, that makes sense. You know, and there is something about one of the things that we don't do enough of is we don't pay attention to history and the lessons learned. If a company will sit down and go, let's do a postmortem on 2023 and take the lessons learned and apply them to our strategy for 2024, then why don't we do the same thing on a national level? Why don't we do that on a personal level, right? So when things happen in the world, we just think that they are the things that they are. You know, you think about what's going on in the Middle East or what have you. Very few people really understand the last 100 years of those particular battles. When you start to understand it, it starts to make somewhat sense. Not to say that you would agree with what has happened, but we just don't think that way.
You know what blew my mind was reading these old translations of Sumerian cuneiform text. And they had a huge war, the gods and the men, in the exact spot that is Gaza.
Oh my God.
7,000-8,000 years ago, maybe. And that's just what we know about. And that, like, I showed it to my husband. I was reading it, by the way, before going to bed. Not a good idea. But he's like, you got to be kidding me. I was like, no, no, no. And there's a map. There's a map in the cuneiform of the area now known as Israel with Gaza. And and they were fighting over what was in Gaza. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is so wild. Like, what's under the ground there? Like, looking at history, and in my world, it's a little more occult or esoteric or weird or fringe, right? But it helps you expand your gaze and you see human existence in epochs more and more archetypally than you do. Like, everything's happening right now. This is the worst time ever. This is the first time anyone's ever had this fear, or the first time this has ever happened in society. It's like, no, this is it's older than dirt.
Right. And you mentioned human existence, but we could also go into like off-world existence. Like, okay, so who's what else is here besides us, you know, and who of us is actually came from off world, you know? Not that it necessarily matters, but it starts putting the attention away from just planet Earth to something much larger, and that there's energies and that there are different layers of consciousness that go beyond our own mental construct that we think we understand, but it's much greater than that. And again, it comes back to intuition. I'm trying not to make the analogy that intuition is the same as being a psychic, or the intuition is the same as being a channeler. I think those are very different skills. Like I know of people who are definite psychics and who are definite, have that skill set. I might at times, but I don't know whether I know that's what it is, right? Now, could I say that I have a better handle on my intuition when it shows up? Yes, I do. I can feel it in my body. I can, once I'm in the present moment, there's a certain sort of like knowing that happens. It's sort of hard to describe because the part of the brain that is intuitive does not also have the ability to language intuition. So it's like,
right,
can't describe the thing because it's coming from a place that language doesn't exist. So that's why we are having such a hard time talking about intuition, because we have to use a different part of the brain to describe it. So all that being said, I do think that there's different levels of this knowing. Intuition is important, but it's not the only one. And I do think that from a standpoint of business and, you know, more interaction in this sort of sentient beings relationship, that intuition is a great sort of first step in terms of tapping into the things that are beyond the known. And I think data and technology is a currency of the known, is the currency of what we know. Intuition is sometimes undocumented, and it's a pattern recognizer that can put that all together, and you start to see something that wasn't there before. Which, incidentally, to your point before, is also the springboard for a lot of innovative ideas.
Yeah.
A lot of creativity comes from that same source, which one might call intuition. So very creative people, sometimes, maybe they don't realize it, are actually quite intuitive. And I do think that everybody has the intuitive muscle. It's just how much you use it and how much you trust it.
And have you noticed a kind of almost species level divergence where some people are hooked into ChatGPT, doing the writing for them, or everything's automated, their home is on that system? And then I've noticed there's a group of people, a lot of my clients are talking to me about this sense of almost intuitive evolution. And to them, they don't have words. So they'll call me and I'm like, just do your best. Rough order of magnitude, I get it, right? And this idea of having these almost like genetic level shifts that are temporal and liminal. And it seems to be happening not at a mass scale, like not everybody, because like I said, some people are kind of going in the other direction, it would seem. But it's happening enough. And a lot of these people, they work in the sciences. So these are geologists. These are not, you know, my people necessarily. And they're experiencing it. And I've never had a moment like this with what I do where people are like, can I just lay something insane out for you? Like a couple times a week, I get that phone call. I'm like, yes. And I'll be like, this is it. I don't know what it is, but it's happening. Have you encountered that? Do you think some of that, you know, there might actually be a new evolutionary moment for humanity?
Yeah. You talk about this popular movement around engaging people, you know, what's more engaging than saying, Rachel, what's your intuition say, and completely tap into that and let's hear it. Now all of a sudden the whole person shows up, right? Rachel, let's get into your big, hairy, weird idea. We want it all, because that's part of who you are, and we respect that. That's how we evolve and change as a species. What we know now is not what we're going to know in the future. So we need all of that. You know, we'll make sense of it later. Absolutely. There's a really, you talk about this idea about language sometimes getting in the way of intuition. You know, it's a construct that is a great tool, but also can be a limiter. There's a wonderful, I forget the name of it, but you may have seen it. There's a gal that did a documentary. It was called, I think it was called NSAE, INSAEI, or something like that. It was basically a gal that was a worked for the United Nations, and she saw some really, really horrible stuff in society, and it just depressed her. And so she partnered up with a filmmaker friend to create a documentary, essentially, about intuition. And it was on Netflix for many years, and then it just stopped. They interviewed shaman, they interviewed scientists, they interviewed, you know, leadership coaches and all sorts of people. But then they came to this performance artist. Her name was Maria, I want to say something like Pukovich, but it's not. She basically is a Museum of Modern Art.
Something Slavic. Yeah.
MoMA. She would basically be in a large room, sit down with the chair and then another chair facing her, and no words were spoken. So going back to language again, she would just sit there, get in the present moment, present purpose and play, right? Tap into her all-knowing. Another person would sit across from her, somebody off the street. And all she would do is just sit there and listen and be present with them. And the energy of them, her being present with somebody else, was so transformative for the other person. They would sometimes cry and have all sorts of experiences because they were finally in the presence of somebody who was present with them. It tapped this deep hunger. And so then this particular installation, this was an art, this is a piece of art, performance art, became so popular, there was a line around the room waiting to get to talk with her, waiting to get to be with her, not talk with her, went out the hallway, out to the street, and around the corner. It was the biggest, most populated, most attended, I should say, event in the Museum of Modern Art's history. Somebody sitting down with somebody else and just being present, just listening.
It was so wild. What you described too about the crying was something I was not prepared for many years ago when I started doing tarot card readings for people, because that's all I did in the beginning. And sometimes, you know, someone busy, very put together, you know, we're in the West Loop of Chicago, right?
Yeah.
Comes in, probably coming in hot, long day, lots to do. And they sit down, and before a word is said, they start having an emotional release. Even I'm not even listening to anything at this point. They're just sitting down and they're crying. And they would look at me and go, I'm so sorry. I do not know what this is or where this is coming from.
Right.
And what I learned over the years of doing it is, oh my God, you haven't sat down in the presence of a human being with intention, right? There's that purpose you mentioned. And there's a feeling of like, oh, I'm going to look at something. This is something different. I haven't done this in a while. I haven't given like almost a somatic reaction to never just sitting down, even doing something or, you know, like some kind of output. It was wild for me. I was like, oh my God, like, because I'm not good with high emotionality. By the way, I'm working on it. Histrionics of all varieties are a great way to get the worst out of me. Side note, where I'm like, are you fucking done crying now? Like, that's what I do. And it's because I didn't have parents. It's my own damage. But it's, you know, I had to learn to like just be quiet and sit with them and explain, like, it's pretty normal. It happens more than you think. And just that, they would feel relief. Of saying, like, this is a thing. And they're like, oh my God, thank you. I'm like, absolutely. You probably need a break, by the way. You probably need to go get a massage.
Right.
Or something. Yeah.
We did that same thing. I took the bold step and thought, well, let's do this in an activity with a team. And they hated me for it. They still hate me for it because they talk about this, the Dean's listening exercise, staring exercise. So I'd have everybody, and you guys can do this who are listening in with your team. We just basically get two people sitting together, almost chair to chair, knee to knee. And all you're doing is, the exercise is just look at each other's eyes for 2 minutes. Don't say anything. Don't try to do anything. Just be in the presence with somebody else for 2 minutes. It's really difficult for a lot of people. And they make it into a joke, or they start doing some funny things to break up how they're feeling about it. But it can actually really create a tremendous sense of intimacy, just being in the presence of somebody. And later on in this particular event that we did, you know, we were doing we were doing some sort of a skit. Like each particular sub-team had the activity to go create a little play around a topic around teamwork or something. So the last group comes up and they sit up in front where the stage supposedly was, and they turned their chairs towards the audience and just sat and looked at us. And we were like wondering, like, what's going on here? Did they forget their lines? Are they disorganized?
Smart asses.
They went, no, they're pulling in that same exercise. And so what was really cool was then the COO at the time, she realizes what's going on. So she grabs her chair and she comes up to one of the other people, or one of the actors, and just sits with them. And now they're doing this connection with their eyes. And then somebody else does it. And after a while, we had the entire team all sitting in silence, looking at each other. And I was blown away. I mean, like, up and down my neck. I was like, this is incredible. And the CEO later says, that was probably the most important thing we've done to help build culture and trust in our entire history, just that little activity. So something as simple as just being present with somebody doesn't take any money, but it's one of those innate human things that we can do. And if there's anything I would leave people with respect to this conversation, is just be present with yourself, be present with somebody else, and just feel what it is. And then maybe intuition comes your way, maybe it doesn't, but that's a huge gift that you can give yourself and other people.
Yeah, and at least it's something novel from what we
do. It is. Yes.
And I love asymmetry. So as you know, you're at the Skeptical Shaman podcast. We have a fascistic sponsor, the Totem Tarot Deck.
I wonder who owns that, Rachel.
CEO owner is a tyrant, not a benevolent tyrant. And if we don't do a card pull, things get rough around here for me for a while. So if it's cool with you, I'll pull a card just about what we've been talking about. See what we can harness. And by the way, I've always done this for real, legitimately, and it's always been kind of creepy, if creepy is a good thing. Is there a word for good creepy?
I don't know.
I don't either. Maybe it's just intuition.
Maybe so.
The Six of Trees card, this is so your energy, by the way, outside of even just this very specific conversation. It's about overcoming fears layer by layer, doing things that you don't typically do, that you might have limiting thoughts around or some imposter syndrome around. And the more you do these things, the more you realize, like, no one's stopping you. There is no red tape. There is no thought police. There is, you know, no one's coming to get you, and you can just go. And it's the sort of jubilant feeling, the exuberance that comes from movement through blockages.
I love it. That's very...
It's a really good card.
The nice gift, and it's apropos in many ways, because I'm writing right now an article for a publication. They wanted me to do something for CEOs and self-care and lonely at the top. And I started kept coming back to this idea that there's imposter syndromes. There's a lot of self-sabotage that we have at that level. But this particular card just sort of reaffirms that notion that I've been working with. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. And thank you. And we'll, of course, put your links in the show notes, but let everybody know where they can find you. Obviously, the Business of Intuition podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you get podcasts.
Yes.
But anything else you want to talk about, websites, social media?
Sure. You have normal stuff, LinkedIn, social media. You know, you can find me there. Our website is MFI, M as in Mary, Frank as in Igloo, or MFI Leadership. Leadership.com. And the podcast, I'll say, is called The Business of Intuition. We're going to continue with our exploration into, you know, human potential within business. We're probably going to change the name to Leadovation. So leadership and innovation coming together. So we're not going to change the platform, but it's going to have a slightly different look. We're excited about that. So it doesn't need to do anything for those of you who are out there, but probably in March, the new name will be, you know, more apparent, but we'll still get into conversations around intuition, because I think it's such an important part of leadership.
Yeah. In the wood dragon year, it's a very good time to make changes and start new things and encourage new growth, new projects. The old is going to have a tough time this year. Yeah.
All right. Good to know. Rachel,
thank you so much.
Light, you're a real gift, and you're real, you know, shining light, and keep it up. It's a pleasure to get to know you.
Oh boy, I think that's a first. Shining light. Namaste. Thank you, Dean.
You're very welcome.
Here at the Skeptical Shaman podcast, we have a few sponsors that make all of these incredible conversations and discussions possible. Please take a moment to listen to a word from our sponsors.
Are you feeling disconnected from magic? Do you find yourself staring out the window in your nondescript workplace, wishing you were among the trees in the sunlight? Are you being slowly drained by your office energy vampire? You know the one. They won't stop talking about our cat. Is at the vet for the third time this month. Is the disembodied hand you purchased from a traveler acting up at night, opening drawers in your bedside table and disrupting your circadian rhythms? Well, Totem Flower Essences might be right for you. Purchase Totem Flower Essences on Etsy, and one drop of these magical potions can alchemically transmute your energy body, arming you with unmitigated powers of sorcery. Totem Flower Essences, be ungovernable. Totem Flower Essences are handmade by an emotionally unstable and morally dubious shaman, potentially injecting your life with raw chaos and magic and the attention of various pagan gods. Use responsibly.